Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm delighted to welcome a very, very accomplished and experienced professional from Chennai, India, Mr. D.V. Sridharan. D.V., welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Ashutosh. I'm honored to be here.
Thank you.
I browsed through many of the interviews you did, and I am highly flattered that you should have thought of interviewing me. Thank you.
Thank you. So, you know, when I started reading about you, you talk about your journey from the sea to the farm. Tell me a little bit about your journey in brief, and then we'll talk about all the other things that you are passionate about.
Quite quickly, I'm now 81, and I was born 5 years before independence.
Wow.
And I've seen three or four phases of life, and it's all about migrations, you know. When I was quite young, most people lived in small villages, and the nearest town was the center of activity. That used to be the bazaar town, where the villagers used to go and buy things.
Mm-hmm.
I come from south, and I come from a village called Damal.
Mm-hmm.
The nearest town is Kanchipuram, you know, the famous Kanchipuram. So there was the first small interaction between these two. People used to oscillate. They didn't know any other world.
Mm.
And then came Madras City after the British East India Company acquired it.
Mm.
That became the big thing, and Kanchipuram receded.
Mm.
So I've seen the first oscillations between my village and Kanchipuram.
Mm-hmm.
Then the slow migration to Madras City. My grandfather was the first lawyer to go and practice in Madras High Court.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have also lived long enough to see the huge migration from India to overseas.
Correct.
First, it began as indentured laborers in Fiji and Trinidad and other West Indies.
Mm-hmm.
And then it came to America and the West, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
I have lived through all the four oscillations.
Amazing.
And my experience practically mapped all this.
Mm.
I come from a small village. I used to only visit with my grandfather. Then I know Kanchipuram very well.
Mm.
I know Chennai very well. And then I went to sea.
Mm.
But as I look at the Indian civilization, how it drifted from its core when it was in the villages and small town Kanchipuram and slowly went overseas, the drift beyond what its true identity was to something else.
Mm.
Identical was my experience. When I finally went to sea, my village receded into a huge power, but I forgotten past.
Mm.
So I turned out to be more of an Anglophile, reading almost entirely in English and writing in English. My Tamil slowly receded.
Mm.
And so it occurred to me at one point that I was far, far away from home.
Mm.
So that's when the return began.
Mm.
And that's what, to answer your simple question in a very long way.
No, it's a great response.
I think once I was at sea, it is an enjoyable life. Nothing that I look back on that I'm unhappy about. I'm very happy about all that I did, including a love for English language. I like it. But the drift I recognize. And when I recognize the drift, well, I knew how, I didn't know how to get back. So that was my second part of the journey. So I told you about the drift.
Fascinating. So when you say that, you know, you chose to alienate yourself and become an Anglophile, a lot of us have done the same thing. I mean, you know, we've all, the fact that you and I are conversing in English means we have chosen to speak in English. But give me one or two interesting anecdotes of your experiences as an Anglophile and what made you suddenly realize that you wanted to come back and discover your roots.
Yeah. I grew up in a Tamil-speaking home.
Mm.
And my father knew Sanskrit, but bless him, wonderful man. But somehow he said, don't bother with Sanskrit. It won't feed you. You learn English, he said. That was an aspirational thing about my generation.
Correct.
Everyone wanted to learn English and become conversant with it. So I used to have a saying of my own many years later, I coined it. Anyone who spoke in English was considered intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who wrote read a whole book was considered an intellectual.
Mm.
So between being able to speak English and read one book, you got made. Life is very easy.
Mm.
So you can get a job everywhere. So I too joined the gravy train. And I said, how to learn to speak English? I couldn't speak English till I was 15, and not fluently, because my first early years were in the Tamil medium school. Then suddenly my father threw me into the English medium school and I got lost. Mm. It took me several years. And I was 16 or 17 when I first read an English book in entirety. Mm. Today, kids read it at 6 and 7 and 8, which is, I'm very cagey and scared about that. But once I loved the English language, I found expressing myself in English was much more terse and precise and pointed. Mm-hmm. There was no poetry when only prose is required. Mm-hmm. So I liked it and I still like it, but it lost my connection with my civilization roots and I miss it now. Mm-hmm. And that is how I mean that I deliberately chose myself to be an Anglophile, means I willingly, wantingly, passionately know English.
Correct.
And I didn't want to write or read it or speak it wrongly, but which I do effortlessly now, and not so effortlessly Tamil now, unfortunately. It is reversed. So that's my quandary, and that's where I am.
Fascinating. You also state, DV, that you groped for your misplaced identity and found an agreeable one after traveling across India. Tell me a little bit about this journey and the self-realization that you went through.
Yeah, I finally quit the sea when I was 30. Mm-hmm. And I came to Chennai and found myself a job. And there was a personal setback. My wife died in a few years. So I said, I don't want to go on as though nothing happened. I can't jump back at the Royal conveyor belt. But I must go and find out what happened to me. So I moved to the countryside. I started living by myself. And read. I used to love reading books. I still do, but as long as my eyes permit it. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I was, for the first time, I was living amidst villages after I grew up. This is about 30 kilometers from Chennai. Mm-hmm. And there was a fishing village, and there was an agricultural village. They were all little clusters. They were all around me. They befriended me. I started seeing them, how completely integrated in the land they were, how invested they were in the Indian soil. And I felt like a stranger. And then I used to read V.S. Naipaul and Niraj Chowdhury and things like that. They used to damn India. And I used to acquire their prejudices too. Then when I saw these people and I said, India can't be as bad as these people make out. Obviously, there's a number of people around the country who are doing the right thing by India. And that's how we kept it going. Mm. So I went out and started discovering these people. And drove myself around. And my return to India began there. And I'm well anchored in India now. although I lost all the gifts of Sanskrit and good Tamil. But still, I made do.
How interesting. You also state, DV, that you know, you discovered a reason for being a Hindu because of its rootedness in environmentalism.
Yeah,
I know you're doing a lot of work with land, which I'll come to in a few minutes.
Yeah,
help me understand how being rooted in the environment attracted you to Hinduism, and were there any other factors?
Yeah, it came about like this. I had never been a non-Hindu. I mean, I have always been a Hindu, but not a practicing one. Mm-hmm. And I don't know enough Sanskrit or shlokas or anything. At sea, we never did any pujas or sadras, nothing. Mm-hmm. But I was a card-holding Hindu. But how I became a passionate Hindu was, during my travels for Good News India, I discovered the second half of the 6 years that I published it, I found myself doing more and more stories on environmentalism, on water harvesting and afforestation and organic agriculture, things like that. When I started doing that, I discovered Hinduism alone, in contrast to Islam or Christianity, being the other two major religions, gives an emphasis on the Panchamahabhuta. That is the five elements. We are grounded in nature. Others, for them, nature is something to serve them to eat and feed and eat off. But for a Hindu, unless you're rooted in your Panchamahabhuta, that is fire, water, earth, akash, and wind,
air,
you just cannot have an experience of the world. We are rooted to the soil. Hindus. That's one of the reasons why Hinduism doesn't easily transplant outside India. You can have your temples in America, but it's not the same rich feel as it is here. It's completely rooted, integrated. So that's when my environmentalism, which I acquired during my travels for Good News India, chimed with the environmentalism the humble villagers are practicing around me. They'll take a fistful of food, put it to their head. They'll offer, worship their tools before they began work. This was completely integrated. And they wouldn't cut certain trees on certain days. And some trees they will never cut. And they would plant certain trees in certain places. Their connection, and they would sow seeds in particular season. And everything was integrated with nature. And they're the natural environmentalists. And that's what I mean by saying, I find in Hinduism most rooted in environmentalism. So that gives me a label to wear as an environmentalist.
Well said. Well said. You also talk about the fact that you are, and to quote you, somewhat angry and pained because you bristle at India being unfairly targeted, coveted, and destabilized. For someone who was born pre-independence, I'd love to get your perspective on how you think India is being unfairly targeted, coveted, and destabilized.
Yeah, I think it was first trying to be seduced during Macaulay's time and trying to flattery. When that didn't work, they started critical analysis of India over a period of time. Mind you, let me give you a big caveat. India is not a perfect society. It never was, nor it'll ever be like any other society. It'll have its flaws. But to its enduring merit, it has constantly produced people who corrected its errors. It has happened throughout our history.
Yeah.
And I come from a Sri Vaishnava tradition, Ramanujacharya, for about 1,000 years ago. He preached Om Namo Narayana, the secret mantra, to the masses. And he was told that since you preached it, you will go to hell. You are not supposed to preach it except to a certain class. And he said, it's rather that I would go to hell that billions of people will go to heaven. So this kind of a reformation has always been going on.
Correct.
And along comes the latter-day civilizations. And sorry, I'm going to name the country in which you live.
By all means.
And whether it's Germany or America, along they come. On the day they discover that they have become superior because they no longer flog the slaves, the whole world must change that instant. Otherwise, it's badly to be certified. It is not to be deemed as good enough. Do you remember in Charles Dickens' father was jailed for not paying a debt?
Correct.
And the public hangings in England used to take place about 300, 400 years ago. I could be entirely wrong.
Yeah.
So suddenly to be preached by these people, I am hugely offended. Now, I noted down a little thing that I wanted to share with you before we spoke. I think there are three fundamentalisms today, you know. One is the religious fundamentalism, you know. Some religions want everybody in their color, in their practice, in their way. Without knowing names, you can guess.
Yeah.
Then there is environmental fundamentalism. A country that is soaked in environmentalism, India, is being preached environmentalism. Do you know, for all the population pressures we have and for all the poverty that we had, we have the largest variety of wildlife?
Correct.
And for 25 years after the British left India, they did not ban the tiger shoot. It took free India 25 years later, after our colonized friends left office, we banned tiger shoot. You can't shoot a peacock in India. There's no hunting. You can't go hunting with... So people preaching in environmentalism to India, that's a bit rich. And the third thing is that I call the first one religious fundamentalism. The second one is environmental fundamentalism. And the third one is sociological environmentalism. You have decided to discover a certain way of life is good for you. And then you begin to preach to others that this is the fundamental way in which everybody must live. And today, India is tired and bored and absolutely no time. Somebody has put us up in the investigation cage or whatever you call that. And they blasted India. We have got caste suspicious. We kill Muslims and we do that. Come and take a look. And if they want to fly afloat, I think, I'll tell you what. I think it's a the so-called leftists are trying to constantly reinvent themselves into new clothes. Mm. And suddenly they pitched upon this story, mm. thinking it'll sell. Mm. It won't fly too far. India has endured many others. Mm. I'm sorry if I run away with my passion.
No. I think yeah. I think you've said something which is a reality, and I also understand exactly what you're saying. But moving on, DV, you are devoting your time to yeah. restore a 20-acre parcel of wasteland into a natural habitat where there is a school for 125 children. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about this project and what has gone into building this project and some of your learnings and challenges.
Yeah, it arose out of, I am not a scholar, I'm not an intellectual, I'm not a much published author. I got one book to show, although mm-hmm. I have written a lot online. I can't go and be a acharya. So what can I do? I can go closer to the villages, work mm-hmm. with hands, and do the things that they do. Right. So I said the only thing that worthwhile that I can do, seemed capable of doing in my life, is to take a piece of barren land and turn it around. I call it the orphaned piece of India. Mm-hmm. An India that nobody wanted. No food had ever grown. There was no topsoil. There was no water. There was no electricity. There was no access. Mm-hmm. And nobody, just the owner was trying to sell it for 40 years and he couldn't find a buyer. People would mm-hmm. come and walk away. Mm-hmm. I said, this is a challenge. Mm-hmm. I'm a marine engineer. We like to do things with our hands. Mm-hmm. So I said, I'm not a rich man, but I have enough money for it. Mm-hmm. I would borrow and no need to. And so I got into this. And just to get ran away with a little bit of poetry in my mind, mm. it's just like Janak Maharaja found Sita from the soil mm. and raised her and groomed her, made her pretty and got her married. I'll take a barren piece of abandoned India that nobody wanted and I'll put trees there and make it very pretty and give it away. Mm. So I began that way. Mm. I turned it around with a water-rich place now with extensive rainwater harvesting. And I bought myself an excavator and dug the swales myself. And slowly the trees began, the weeds began to come, the rushes began to come, the trees. Then I planted trees, never for income or mostly to build a habitat where animals and birds can come. Mm. That was it. I don't think, see, if I measured my success on a scale of 100, mm. I think I had done about 35, 40. Mm-hmm. It's a long, long way, and I'm 81. Mm-hmm. So just to ensure that this land doesn't fall in somebody else's hand and they vandalize what I have done and start building a wedding hall or a hotel, I gave it to a school. Mm-hmm. I said, you run a school there, teach children the environmentalism that it taken for us to come this far. Ask them to, I go and talk to the children too. I said, cherish the water. And I repeat this, anyone who has heard me and known me in life, they would be hearing it for the 100th of time. Mm-hmm. W.H. Auden, the poet, said, thousands of men have lived without love, mm-hmm. not one without water. Mm-hmm. So let's get our priorities right. But first of all, love everyone. All right, after I had a drink of water. All right. Mm-hmm. So a primacy of water, primacy of trees, primacy of soil, primacy of husbandry. That's what environmentalism is all about. Mm. And I mentioned environmental fundamentalism.
Yep.
And there is an environmental fundamentalism that's going on. Mm. A pull off nuclear air power, shut down all industries, zero growth. Mm. These guys can't live with a day without electricity. Mm. They can't live a day without a transportation of their own.
Yeah.
And then they would preach a fundamentalism of environmentalism. Mm. And they lit into Alfred Lovelock, James Lovelock, when he preached, nuclear power has proved itself safest. It has got the least accident. So let's have a terminable affair with nuclear power until we develop good renewable energy. Our renewable energy will not feed the world now. Mm. It cannot. Solar, wind, they cannot. Mm. Nuclear can. Great. And the safety record is good. So this is environmental fundamentalism, so out with everything. I'll only eat grass. I've got to uncook. Because if I cook, there'll be global warming. This kind of a fundamental idiocy is what I fight.
Well said. And even my last question to you, and this is for the many, many people who will listen to our conversation. As someone born 5 years before independence, who seems to have, you know, seen so much of the world and now is gone back to the grassroots, to Mother Earth, what would you say are three lessons from your own life and your journey that you would want our viewers and listeners to take away?
From my life, I would say, don't follow my life and don't follow my track. don't leave, don't go too far from home.
Okay.
Stay put in your culture. And at least until 17, 18, until you feel well grounded, don't leave it. And secondly, whether or not you like it, you're living off someone else's environmental work, you know, and that's what that that's what you're benefiting by. Try and find out what you can do to contribute to that. I mean, it doesn't have to be large scale. It can be your backyard. And turn the third consists of A and B. And always stay in love with India. And B, fight it out with people who badmouth India.
Well said. Well said. And on that note, and I completely agree with all your thoughts that you have expressed so far and your amazing three lessons. Don't go far from home. Stay with your own culture. Find what you can do for the environment. You don't have to do something which is earth-shattering, but you can do it in your own backyard. And the stay one, third one you said was stay in love with India and defend our country against so many different kinds of assaults that keep happening, and more specifically, the three you spoke about. Thank you, DV, for speaking to me about your own amazing journey.
Thank you. I hope I met with your standards.
Thank you so much, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Ashutosh.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.